Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Paul, officers allege racism in the Anchorage Police Department. It's a very serious charge. Chief Mew came out with a rebuttal. Give us the basics and the background.
The basics, some years ago, the department was sued by an officer claiming discrimination in the department. They settled with him. Now we have two officers, a Hispanic and an African-American, veteran officers, 20 years apiece, I think, yes. Undercover work in the drug unit. They're claiming in their lawsuit, seeking more than $100,000, that the department promotes and disciplines minority officers differently than it does white officers, and that the command structure of the police department is bereft of many minorities. They said that this also carries off on how the department deals with the public. So they're suing. They're seeking the $100,000 plus. Police Chief Mew has said, of course, we don't tolerate that here. We're not going to have that here. We don't have that here. And so that's where we stand right now, and this thing proceeds.
And for the moment, it's a he said story
until we get
more information.
Right.
Although these kind of allegations would strike at the heart of every police department all over the country.
Which I think is why the city has a reputation for settling lawsuits. I mean, for the most part, self-insured. It costs a lot of money to go to court, tremendous amount of money. And they have a penchant to settle if they can save money. I think in this case, in this type of case, you go all the way. You have to go to court. You have to do the interrogatory. You have to get all the questions answered so that the people of the city know what kind of police department they've got.
Okay, Steve, your assessment and what happens next?
I agree with Paul. These are real serious allegations. It's striking at the culture of the Anchorage Police Force, which it enjoys a very good reputation here in town. I think in the eyes of the public, it's a good police force. But is there something wrong with its culture on the inside there that needs to be answered? And to settle this case before it goes to trial for a sum of money, you would really be, you'd be glossing over these allegations.
And presumably the plaintiffs would like some acknowledgement that they raised serious issues.
Right, and you'd want to see this addressed. Yeah, you want to see some solutions, if indeed there are these kinds of problems. And as far as what is next, the city has 20 days, less than that now, because the lawsuit was filed earlier in the week, but the judge gave them 20 days, the city 20 days, to respond to these allegations, and that'll be the next step when we see what the city and how it responds. But again, these are very serious charges, and deserve an airing. And if they decide, this is going to be very costly to the city budget, so we better settle this, then I would hope that Chief Mew would say, okay, we'll settle this legal matter, get this out of the way, but we're going to form some sort of a committee to study what really goes on here within our ranks.
Paul, still the question is, we've been hearing a lot of, do you feel safe? Are you safe in Anchorage? This is a public safety question, and it's also a question of, do we have enough police officers? We were chatting about that earlier, mm-hmm. and maybe could develop that a little bit.
We are the more liberal faction of the assembly, and the mayor are kind of involved in a brouhaha over how many police do we need. The public doesn't feel safe. We really need to go. I don't know whose figures are used. I feel safe, as long as Steve's controlled, of course. I feel safe, and I'm not sure who feels unsafe or why.
Yeah.
Crime stats are dangerous things to use in an argument, because depending on how you look at a crime is how it goes down as a stat. So the mayor is saying, what we need to do is have the police academy that the more liberal wing of the assembly wants to have. We'll do that later next year, because he's facing a $20 million deficit next year. He's got to figure out how to do this. More liberal wing of the assembly wants $200,000 to have that, to get ready to have that earlier in the year, because we need more officers to replace the ones that are retiring and that sort of thing. Police Chief Mew, I think, has the best approach. He says, I don't feel like I'm stretched thin. Most of my shifts are okay. Everybody's out there. We have a management audit going on, a deployment kind of a survey that at the end of which we'll know how we're using our officers. Can we use them more effectively? Do we need two officers in a car at this time of day or only one? And so he's saying, let's get all that done. And the mayor's saying that as well. Let's get all that done. And then we can figure out what we're going to do. But as far as the safety thing, I talk to people all the time. I don't know who feels unsafe or why.
Yeah. Well, a certain number of people feel unsafe all the time.
Well, right? There's also...
But the question is are the numbers changing, I think?
There's also the potential that the numbers don't mean much in that the police department's had a real effort going on with drugs. So I imagine if you looked at the numbers, you'd see an increase in drug crime. But it's mostly an increase focused by the police department.
That would be arrest then, or...
It would be arrest, sure.
Okay. Steve, you had something you wanted to add here.
These were horrible events that occurred in a relatively short period of time, highlighted by the fact that two officers from APD were shot and wounded. One person, the most recent shooting was the police officer had stopped a car. She suspected the person in the car of making a drug deal. I don't want to be callous or cold here, but that comes with the job. She's a sworn officer who is trained to handle those kinds of situations, and unfortunately she's put in those kinds of situations just by the very nature of her job. She's going to be dealing with dangerous people, and unfortunately this guy had a gun and used it, and she was wounded. Thankfully she's recuperating, and the same thing with Officer Allen, the first officer who had been shot some months ago. Thankfully he's recovering, but I don't know how many more police officers on the street could have stop those. There's a fellow whose roommate allegedly stabbed him with a butcher knife and killed him. I don't know how many more police officers on the street could have stopped something like that. The guy walking down the street, he gets shot and killed late at night. And I'll tell you what, the media has a role in this too, because a lot of this is psychological. What we put on the air, we have to be really careful too, what we report and how we report it and put it in the right context. There's a story I tell my staff and they kind of roll their eyes. I'm sure they're tired of hearing it, but there was a woman by the name of Carol Nealon who was a very famous and groundbreaking news director in Austin, Texas. She was looking at crime statistics in the early 1990s and saw the violent crime was dropping at tremendous rates around the country, especially in New York City. That's when Mayor Giuliani had declared war on the squeegee men, and crime rates tumbled, and it did that all across the country. Yet people in polls were saying that they're more fearful of crime than ever. And she says, well, what's the relationship here? The country's safer than ever, but people are more fearful than ever. And she realized, well, it's the news media putting on every 7-Eleven heist, and we've got video of somebody getting clubbed over the head from a security camera, so let's air that kind of thing. People just saw night after night, story after story of crime that, you know, and I think that played into people's fears as well. So, I mean, these are serious crimes, the ones that we reported here, but I know we have to be careful about how we portray it and portray it in the correct context here, too. But and I think people have to kind of step back and really look at these situations as well. And I don't know if more police, it would be great to have a cop on every street corner, right?
Thank you very much, Steve. We're going to stay with the law here. The legislature, at the behest of Governor Parnell, passed some sweeping changes in the bail laws. These changes went into effect on July 1st, the beginning of the new fiscal year. Now a group of defense lawyers and members of the ACLU have come forward to challenge these laws. There was a hearing in Judge Peter Michalski's court today asking for a temporary restraining order. This was on behalf of the plaintiffs, the defense bar, and the ACLU. And by the end of the day, the judge indicated that he will have a ruling on whether to suspend these laws temporarily while they can be looked at, presumably, in court. The changes are significant to certain kinds of defenders, particularly people who might be involved in domestic cases and drug cases. But they really, in some other ways, shift the burden to the the person who has been arrested. The arguments in today were the state arguing against the TRO was essentially that the case wasn't ripe and that the defense bar, which had come forward, didn't have standing because none of them were personally affected. Well, they wrangled about this for an hour and a half, and it wouldn't surprise you the defense bar had numerous examples, or their lawyers representing them, of how they thought that this would affect their clients, potential defendants, and anybody who was in need of bail. I think it's really important to understand that bail is very old in the American and English system. It's been to some degree controversial for a long period of time, but it was only in the 1950s that the United States Supreme Court said about bail that bail has to be commensurate with the offense, and that you just can't put people in jail on very high bail that you know they can't make because you want to keep them around as a witness or in some other way want to have them available to you. That bail had to be commensurate with what you were charged with. So that part of the law is very new. We'll see what the judge has to say by the end of the day Friday, and I'm sure that this is something that'll be talked about all weekend. Judge Michalski did not give any indication about how he might rule. Steve, Carlock Manor, the proposed homeless and indigent shelter and home and apartment, has come under some new suggestions, some new debate. What's the update on Carlock Manor? First of all, where is it?
Down on Carlock, in the Fairview area.
Right.
And it's the old Red Roof Inn.
Right.
And Rural Cap wants to take this facility over. It wants to make a permanent home for homeless people, people who are chronic inebriates, and it's a new approach to dealing with inebriates and homeless folks, but it would be a permanent home in the old motel there. There has been a number of concerns from the community council down in that area, saying that we don't want this kind of a facility there, lots of other concerns. So Rural Cap has gone and changed some of its guidelines or for who can actually be housed there. People with violent histories of crime, also sexual abuse, wouldn't be permitted to stay there. They said that they would also serve meals there 7 days a week rather than just 5 days a week. They also said that Fairview Park, the park that's nearby the facility anyways, would be patrolled and cleaned, I think they said once a week, so neighbors would feel safer in the park, and if there was any harm done to the park, it would be cleaned and fixed by Rural Cap. So they're hoping that that would be enough to persuade the community council to drop its objections to that facility. It still has to go get permitted through planning and zoning, so it still has a few more hurdles to go through, including that park situation. The rules state that that kind of a facility has to be so far away from a park, and I think it's within those parameters. So they're going to have to get around that hurdle with a special permit, and that's going to be problematic for them.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Paul, there's been some suggestion that people with criminal records won't be allowed to live in this facility. What do you know?
It's a violent criminal records, people with the violent crimes, and the sexual assault, that sort of thing, sexual offenders. They'll be barred from there. I think it makes sense. And in addition to the things that Steve was talking about, they're going to staff it now. They plan to staff it now 24 hours a day.
Yeah, sorry, it's a
so, they're doing what they can. Rural Cap, the organization that's going to be in control of this, is trying to do everything it can to appease the Fairview Community Council, which has really put up a pretty stiff wall of opposition to this facility. It remains to be seen if any or all of this will have an effect on the people on that council or not. As Steve pointed out, it's got a long way to go before it's approved, and the people have a lot of time to.
Okay, let's turn to politics quickly here. The campaign is entering a central phase. I've gotten emails from various candidates from governor talking about all the parades they're going to be in this week, all the people they're meeting. Paul, are the challengers to Governor Sean Parnell, our sitting governor, are they getting any traction right now?
I think it's difficult for them, too. They're not getting much media. They're not getting much news space. I think they are chipping away at his favorable rating, which is as of early May was hanging around 60-70%.
Yeah, pretty high.
He filled a niche in this state when Sarah Palin left, and I think people are comfortable with that. His challengers are having a difficult time getting him to debate. They're having a difficult time getting in the same room with him. It's hard to compare yourself to someone when they won't play. And I think that's a political strategy. I mean,
that's central to any political strategy.
Sure.
Is coming up with comparison. Take a look at him.
Exactly.
Take a look at me, Steve. Usually by this time we can say there's a dominant issue. Is there one this time? Is it emerging?
I'll tell you, no. There's a few issues. You know, Ralph Samuels has come out with his campaign spots, and he asks the question, what are we being run by, liberals, I guess? I think that's what he said. But he talks about all the things that are kind of going on in the state of Alaska right now, and I think he's drawing the comparison.
I think there are very few people who think that's happening, at least in Alaska.
Yeah, but he's saying that, you know, supposedly there's the Republicans, conservative Republicans, who are at the helm of the state, but look at all this, and you know, he's the true conservative.
Spending
kind of
too
thing.
Much, for one thing.
Spending too much, that's always going to be a big issue there, the budget. When Governor Parnell approved the capital and operating budget, he made some vetoes. Predictably didn't go far enough. You know, that was something that the people on the Republican side of the ledger complained about. People on the Democratic side, of course, said that he cut the wrong things. It's a real tough time if you are a popular incumbent, and that's what Sean Parnell is right now. He's a popular incumbent. He's got the bully pulpit. He's made a lot of right moves. He really hasn't made any big mistakes or any gaffes out there that I can think of. And people are out fishing right now, and they're outside enjoying the Alaska summer. They're not watching TV. They're not paying attention to this to any great account. So it's really frustrating for
And I read a story the other day
challengers.
That said Alaska is one of only four states that is not cutting the budget. And then, of course, it went into great detail about California.
Yeah.
Okay, a year ago, Steve, we know what we were doing this weekend. We were covering Sarah Palin's resignation, although you were out of town and were stage managing it from far away.
You've got a great memory. But, that's one of those things like, where were you when this happened? And it's always going to...
Well, in the last year, Steve, Sarah Palin has become very rich. What else has she done?
She's built a fence, a big fence around her yards, and she's become very rich.
The evil Joe McGinnis.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, she's got a new neighbor, she's got a new fence, and she's made a lot of money, and she wrote a book, and that pretty much sums things up. No, that's giving her the short shrift. She has become a political icon. Icon?
Sure.
Okay, I did. In the country, and she has been the person who is setting a lot of debates. At least, kind of, she's calling the shots on some of these issues. Who knew, huh? When she got that job as a Wasilla Assemblywoman so many years ago, that she'd be doing this. She's setting the agenda for some of these races in many states across the country. She's kind of the Tea Party's pit bull, if you will, to go out there, or maybe more appropriately, the Mama Grizzly, going out there and going after the liberal candidates or the conservative candidates who aren't conservative enough.
I think one of the things that happens when we talk about Sarah Palin is we always have a surfeit of metaphors.
We
Doesn't
do.
That seem to be the
Which
case?
She's set. Yeah, she's the one who started. And she started a string of metaphors. That's another thing.
That's another thing she did.
Got her own team.
Yeah,
Paul, the historian Daniel Boorstein famously said, a celebrity is somebody who gets in the news and stays in the news. Is Sarah Palin a political leader, a celebrity, a multimillionaire?
Yes.
All of those and things we're not even talking about.
Right.
Yeah. No, she's a celebrity. She's and she makes it's a conscious effort to stay in the news, get in the news early in the week, stay in the news if you can. She's come to the point now where whatever she does is news. She goes and makes a speech at a second-rate college about a third-rate subject, and you've got you've got reporters standing around writing it all down. Mm-hmm. So I mean, she's hit that point where she's beyond a curiosity to the news media.
But she doesn't go meet the press.
She now is a beat. No, well,
oh,
and
no.
They're not going to let that happen. They don't let her go where she has to answer questions. direct contact with hard questions would be a very bad thing, I think.
Maybe
she's being coached behind the scenes. I don't know if she's going to run for president or not, but if she is, she's got to get over that. She's got to be able to go one-on-one, one-on-ten, and win. And I don't know if she can do that or not.
Okay, moving right along. You walk into the liquor store, and the clerk looks at your white hair, in my case, and says, please show me your ID and prove
your
age.
Was that a cheap bald head shot?
No, no, I was referring to myself. We now have, we had or tried to have mandatory ID for people who are buying alcoholic beverages. What's the premise here?
You know, I really have never understood it. Mike Gutierrez, Assemblyman Mike Gutierrez, decided that what we need to do is check everybody's driver's license when we sell them booze. The idea, supposedly, is to keep minors, and never kept me away from it, keep minors from buying alcohol.
But the statutes have run out of limitations.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And to, I'm hoping,
maybe.
On that and a lot
now
of other things.
Now that you just admitted to it, I don't know.
And to enforce the state law that requires red stripes on a driver's license for somebody with an alcohol conviction. And that's ostensibly what they're trying to do. Yeah, let's do it voluntarily. Well, yeah, and then, like everything else done voluntarily, they'll do it for a while, and then they didn't. There's only one store in town that had to do it, and that was over on Muldoon, I guess, on Muldoon Brown Jug. Mm-hmm. And it was part of their zoning approval, was that they had to mandatorily check. Well, they're the only ones in town now doing it, so Brown Jug is saying, hey, we can't compete if you're going to keep it this way. So there's a hearing July 27th. And then I guess everybody will sit down, make their case, and they may pull that. They may not have to do it mandatorily either.
Steve, is the ID plan accomplishing anything, or is it just annoying the general public?
Well, I prefer to think of it as I'm just so young and pretty that they have to ask for my ID to make sure that I am 21. So I just leave it at that. But it's probably annoying a lot of customers, too. And I don't know what it is accomplishing. You know, they've got to ask for IDs. They should ask for IDs, I guess. If there are folks that have that red stripe, like Paul was talking about, they should look for that. And so maybe that is, you know, if they're doing it for everybody, if they're going to do it, they should do it for everybody. All stores should be told that they have to do it. And not voluntarily, it's got to be part of the law. You can't just single out one store and say, you guys got to do that. Nobody else has to. You got to do it.
And if you travel, there are places, particularly sports stadiums that I've been to, where every person who gets any alcoholic beverage is always asked.
Yeah.
So people do get used to it after a while.
I think so. You know, it's almost like going to the airport. You got to go through, ask a lot of questions. You got to show people your ID. You got to go through metal detectors. It's just, you know, if it is going to save a person's life at some particular point in time or prevent a crime from being committed because somebody too young is getting soused up or whatever, then it's worth it. But everybody should be required to do it and not single out one store.
Okay, on another matter, the Wall Street Journal, after examining a number of BP's documents, reports that BP's just not doing a very good job on the safety question of its facilities by almost the own admission of the company. What do we think about here in Alaska?
When these things were happening, the corrosion issue for once, you kind of look at it and just say, oh, okay, you guys are messing this up. You guys got to get on top of this corrosion problem with the pipes that led to a 200,000-gallon spill up on the North Slope that went undetected for how long? So you say, okay, bad luck, bad management there. You guys need to clean it up. And BP went on and said, hey, well, look, we just spent like so many odd million dollars and got all this new pipe, so we're going to fix this. And we've got all these people up there now who are checking the pipes for corrosion. So you kind of could chalk it up to, all right, they fell down on the job. But now, you know, you get plants that are exploding. You got a rig that explodes. You've got this huge mess out in the Gulf of Mexico. You start wondering.
Not to mention the walrus in the Gulf of Mexico.
The walrus.
They're dead now.
The walrus in the Gulf of Mexico and their cleanup plan. Contingency plan, yes. Yeah, now you start saying, okay, this is a cultural issue in that company that, you know, and you have to also point the finger, I think, at federal regulators, too. Okay, what is your job? You know, okay, these guys have to adhere to the laws. You guys have to enforce the laws. So it's not just BP, but there seems to be a cultural problem at that company, unfortunately. And there also seems to be a cultural problem with the federal regulators who oversee these companies.
Paul, in 30 seconds, were you surprised to learn from the reporting that not much has changed in the ability of people who want to capture oil that's on water to be able to do it. The technology hasn't changed much in 20 years.
I guess I'm stunned by that. You would think an industry would tax itself, put together some kind of a research facility. Look how much money this is going to cost, not just BP.
Right.
But in goodwill and suspicion with all the other oil industries.
Oh, absolutely.
You think they would put together a research facility and know how to do this, figure out what the worst case is going to be, and then figure out how to fix it and try to avoid it.
Right.
But this is the kind of thing, it's just, it's going to destroy them.
Yeah.
Finally, before we move on, I did some reporting and I checked in with some attorneys. It seems that clear that a trial for Bruce Weirach, Juneau legislator who was indicted for corruption, is scheduled for September. The defense attorneys are assuming that he will go to trial. The complaint against him or the indictment will have to be in some measure altered because one of the charges has been gone to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has found that particular approach to theft of honest services really isn't clear of how it would be applied in the law. It's too vague. Nevertheless, my understanding is unless something changes dramatically and soon, he will face trial in September. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you right here next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.